Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
It's kind of the nomenclature of a law firm isn't creative. I would say a law firm has to be creative. If you have clients who are faced with challenges that have never been faced before and who are trying to negotiate and have mergers, I mean, negotiation is a creative endeavor, right? Finding a path and finding a solution is inherently creative. And I think it's about reframing and reshaping and giving your lawyers the permission to think creatively about how are we going to build our book of business, right? How are we going to acquire new clients or differentiate ourselves from the other white shoe law firm down the street? You know, there are lots of ways to bring creative thinking into those kinds of environments. But I think it takes kind of a reframe, reshaping of what the expectations are and really giving yourself permission to do things in a different way. And that's what companies and clients really are after.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. And welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
It's great to be here, Srini.
It is my pleasure to have you here. So I found out about your work by way of your publicist, all of which we will get into. But before we start, I wanted to start by asking you, what is one of the most important things that you learned from one or both of your parents that have influenced and shaped where you've ended up and what you've done with your life?
Well, I'm super close with my parents. I learn something from them all the time. And I think one of the things that I take, especially now that I am a parent, is this concept of letting your kids fail and their support of my stumbling. And I think, you know, one of the things that I I did early on was really follow my heart in terms of my pursuit of creative expression. And that meant singing, acting, dancing. I kind of grew up in the theater. I thought I would do it for a lifetime. And I went to Northwestern, studied theater there, and ended up deciding to drop out because I got my equity card. I thought I was going to, you know, go pro, which I did for a while. But you can imagine, I know you can relate to this, Srini, right? The parents of, you know, they were public servants. My mom was in education, you know, teacher, principal, you know, CEO of a charter school. My dad was in Social Security for his whole career. So they're public servants. And here is their child dropping out of Northwestern University, probably not their proudest moment, but they let me do it, and they supported me through that, and they made that decision. They let it be mine, and I think that was a really powerful moment in our relationship. Would I do that again? Maybe not. Would I advise my kids to do that? Maybe not. Yeah. But I think the unconditional love and letting me kind of stumble my way through it was a really powerful lesson.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, you went to business school at Stern, you went to undergrad at Northwestern. I'm like, oh, wow, you went to the two places that I got rejected. I applied to the Northwestern School of Music and didn't get in. But I remember going to Evanston thinking, I was like, the weather here sucks. And when I didn't get in, I was like, you know what? That was a blessing in disguise.
Right.
But this conversation about dropping out,
particularly when you go to a place like Northwestern, because I remember having a conversation with my dad about taking a semester off of Berkeley so I could go work. And my parents were like, we know you well enough to know that if you start making money, you'll never go back. So talk to me about how you navigate that conversation without them thinking, what the hell are you thinking? Have you lost your mind? You just got into Northwest, you know, you're at Northwestern, one of the best schools in the country, and you want to drop out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, gosh, I think the conversation went a little bit like, well, here I am racking up all of this student loan debt. And here I am with the opportunity to, like you said, earn a living, you know, get some money, doing what I want to do, my passion. You know, it's why I'm in school. You know, I was a theater major, and here I was given the opportunity to do it professionally. And I think for me, I had such a strong work ethic, and that is something that I got from my parents, you know, no doubt. Just the value of working hard, you know, earning your own path. That opportunity was too compelling. And, you know, I think we kind of reached an agreement that, hey, you can always go back. There's always an opportunity to return. You know, I ended up not returning to Northwestern. I got my degree online. But, you know, I think that was an okay solution in their mind. And they understood that my drive to perform and to do that in the professional setting was such a strong passion that if I had said no to that, that would have been more harmful and more disappointing and more of a disappointment, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that you're a parent now, and this is something I always wonder. I wonder what this will be like when I become a parent, because I think there's sort of two sides to this coin, right? We think about all the things that we won't do that we, our parents did to us. We're like, oh, that's one thing I'm never going to do, and because it didn't turn out the way I wanted it to. But I wonder how you think about those things. Like, what are the things you think you're not going to repeat? Because I feel like everybody says that, and apparently they just repeat the same things. Like, I have a friend who has a teenage daughter. I was like, do you ever find yourself sounding like your parents when you're lecturing your daughter? He was like, now that you mention it, yeah.
It's really tough not to fall into those patterns, Srini. I think that's every parent's just plight. But I think, you know, one thing that I've learned from my kids is just how different they are, and how you really have to meet the child and meet every individual where they are. And no two kids are alike. I mean, my sister and I were very different growing up, and my kids are quite different as well. And I think just tuning into what their needs are in the moment and writing that out. And sometimes it's not always easy, but just being present is the lesson that I try to take with me.
Yeah. It's funny that you say like no two kids are the same. And I've been going back to Gabor Mate's book on ADD called Scattered Minds. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he talks about is no kid is raised by the same two parents, even if they are in the same family, because of the life stage that they're at. Like, I realized my sister and I had wildly different upbringings, and she probably had a very different experience of navigating the relationship with my parents than I did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a really interesting insight. And yeah, I mean, parents have their own stuff going on, you know, to raise kids, especially in the middle of a global pandemic, and launch a business and try to stay sane. I mean, that's a tall order for anyone. And I think we've all learned a lot through this phase in our life and in history.
Yeah. Well, talk to me about what happens after you drop out of Northwestern, because I think that, you know, you and I both know a career in the arts, particularly if you're talking about theater or acting, the odds that you're going to be successful are really low, you know, like one in a million. I mean, even being an author, the odds are unlikely. I remember asking my editor, Stephanie, at Penguin once, like, what are the odds that somebody gets a book deal? Like, how many people want one and how many people end up here? Because I needed to rub it in my dad's face and say, this is actually harder than it is to get into medical school. He wasn't having any of it, but it was like one in 5,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, for me, I had been doing it for such a long time since I was a kid. And, you know, I did it professionally in Chicago. I moved to New York, did it professionally there for a while. I was in New York during 9/11, kind of dating myself here. But that was a pivotal moment for me to just kind of zoom out and figure, you know, gosh, someday I want to be able to buy a house. I want to be able to have a family. And there are plenty of performers who end up doing that. And they make their way of it. But I just really was craving more stability and a different kind of intellectual stimulation, I guess. So that's kind of when I made my pivot to business and joined a startup. You know, I thought that that was more stable. It shows how little I knew about the startup world, but ended up staying there for over a decade and growing this business and scaling it from seven people to thousands. And that was kind of my aha moment that creativity in business is just as applicable as in the arts. So that kind of tapping into your creative thinking is a real skill that's useful.
Well, you know, I want to spend a bit more time talking about the time that you spent in theater. There are probably numerous things that come about in terms of navigating, you know, profound uncertainty on a day-to-day basis, wondering sometimes probably how you're going to pay rent the next month before you hit that point of, okay, I want more stability. How did you manage your psychology and not lose your mind?
creativity, my friend. That's what we're talking about. And I think, you know, figuring, I mean, gosh, when I was living in New York, I was waiting tables. I was a nanny. I was an executive assistant at a real estate company. I was also performing. I mean, I was wearing all these different hats and was really just, I was a big planner. I still am a big planner. So I think if you kind of plan it all out and you figure, okay, this is what I need to do to make this work and to pay my rent and to live in the city, you figure out a way. There's always a way. Yeah. But you have to have that drive and commitment to find a path, whatever it is.
Talk to me about the sort of day-to-day discipline and habits that come from being a theatrical performer and how you've applied those in other areas of your life.
Yeah. I mean, I write a lot about that now, just the connecting the dots from the arts and what I really learned about collaboration and leadership and building empathy and, you know, a lot of the skills that now apply in the workforce and that are really sought after in today's work environments, I learned from the theater and connecting with lots of different people. You know, I went to the High School for the Arts here in Los Angeles, LOXA, and that was really an incredible training ground to connect with lots of different creative people to build something of value, you know, and to play off of each other in a way that melded all of our different strengths and backgrounds. I mean, there were folks who, you know, came from very Tony neighborhoods and folks who didn't have a home, and having that rich diversity as kind of your palette as a teenager was incredibly transformational for me to just see different ways of living, to experience different humans, and then to come together with a united mission of we're focused on our craft, we're dedicated to building our artistic discipline. It was an incredible experience.
Yeah. Hey, it's Srini. I want to tell you about something new that we've been building for you. The Unmistakable Collective is a monthly membership for writers, bloggers, podcasters, and content creators who want to build an audience for their work. As a member of the collective, you get access to exclusive content that we don't publish anywhere else, three monthly events, including office hours, Q&A sessions with former podcast guests, and regular workshops to help you develop the foundational skills you need for building an audience. And it only costs $30 a month. If you want to build an audience for your blog, write a book, or start a podcast of your own, go to unmistakablecreative.com/collective to learn more. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/collective.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Well, you know, I think that you're very lucky. I mean, I was really fortunate that my parents dragged me around the world, which I thought was a negative until very recently when my sister kind of said, you got to stop complaining about this. And I realized that she was right because they basically taught me to be a citizen of the world. And yet, if you look at the way that we socialize people, we educate people, and how people consume content, we basically program people to have these very myopic worldviews now. And you're talking about diversity and you know, being able to collaborate with people from different backgrounds, people with different belief systems. How do you bridge that gap from a, you know, between the myopic viewpoint and having people not get stuck in echo chambers? Because I remember, you know, when I wrote my first book, I jokingly always said the title of this book could have just as easily been called Everybody is Full of Shit, even though Penguin wouldn't have published that. But I realized that I just kept seeing this sort of myopic worldview over and over again, where people would just see something in an echo chamber and then wonder why they couldn't stand out.
Yeah. I mean, I think it comes down to listening. And again, empathy is huge, to really take a moment to walk in someone else's shoes and to imagine what that must feel like is a really powerful skill and much needed in today's world, in business, certainly, but as a citizen of the world, like you say. So I think that really helps. And I think just finding, hey, what do we have in common? How do we find some common ground that really unites us and brings us together? We are different and we want to celebrate that, but let's find that common ground first and build off of that.
Yeah. Well, so you know, going back to parenting, I know what Redondo Beach is like, and you know, you went to Northwestern, I went to Berkeley. We both came from fairly privileged circumstances, relatively. How do you maintain that sort of diverse worldview in your kids when they're growing up in an environment like the ones they're in, they're growing up in?
Yeah, it's. I think that's a constant challenge for any parent. I think, you know, thankfully they can get exposure to different ways of living. You know, due to the pandemic, we haven't really been traveling all that much, but you know, our hope is that we can travel to lots of different places where they can get a window into that and start to kind of get out of themselves. Because you're absolutely right. There is an echo chamber. There is kind of a feeling that, oh, everyone lives right by the beach. It's not true. So I think that that next step is going to be really important for our family, certainly.
Yeah. Well, tell me what your sort of low point was when you were in theater that made you finally say, okay, that's it. I am done with this. I need to find something more stable. Like, what was the catalyst for that?
Yeah. I mean, I think certainly 9/11 was the start of that catalyst. And I think, you know, there just reached a point where I could have stuck it out, but I had been doing it for so long that kind of I wanted a different kind of challenge. And I think, you know, probably like you, Srini, I love to learn. I love challenges. I kind of lean into them. When anything feels comfortable to me, it's time to make a change. So I was really looking for, okay, what's my next challenge? What's going to get me out of my comfort zone? And for me, that was kind of joining a company and trying to figure that out and build this business. And so I liked that, the intellectual challenge of it and needing to get creative and figure out how are we going to grow this business. But certainly, I mean, there are low points all the time. That was certainly one when the world felt like it was crashing down.
Yeah. So I've talked to two people who were in New York on 9/11, Emily Fletcher and Susanna Scully, both of whom have been guests here. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one thing for those of us who watched 9/11 unfold on TV versus people who were actually there. And I'm just curious what that day was actually like. If you're somebody who's a citizen of New York, do you remember it in vivid detail? What were you scared of? You know, what was going through your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I remember it quite well. And I had the presence of mind to kind of write down what I had experienced after the fact as well. And I think I got off the F train in Soho right after the second plane had hit. And I just remember kind of walking around the neighborhood. I was walking to the office that I worked at the time, and people would kind of watch all these, you know, ambulances racing down Broadway, and just thinking that it was a fire in the building. And just, I'll never forget that moment of ignorance where we didn't really understand the magnitude of what had happened. And people just thought, oh gosh, what a terrible fire. We could see the smoke kind of coming out of the buildings. But, you know, I think that day obviously changed everyone's life in some way, touched everyone. But as a New Yorker at the time, it really did bring people together. And there was kind of an unspoken knowing, you just kind of make eye contact with people on the subway, that everyone is going through the same thing at the same time. And I think we're experiencing something similar, certainly with the pandemic, where everyone is a bit traumatized from what's happened. So it's an interesting moment.
Did you lose any close friends?
I didn't, thankfully. You know, certainly knew people who were immediately impacted, but you know, I didn't lose anyone that day. And you know, I think, you know, just reflecting on how that shifted a lot of people's kind of path, you know, a lot of people decided to leave the city, again, similar to the pandemic, and just wanted to live every day in a different mode of ramping up the gratitude and ramping up the presence, just enjoying what we have.
Yeah. I wonder, when you are confronted with the reality of mortality at such an early age, what decisions did you make about how you would live your life going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's similar to anyone who experiences something pretty shocking like that, a big tragedy that is shared by many people. It does force you to reflect and be really intentional about what you want in life. And, you know, for me, I wanted that stability. I wanted to be able to have a family, you know, just wanted a little bit more self-direction and control over my destiny. And as a performer, you're often at the mercy of the casting director or, you know, what opportunities exist in a certain piece. It's a lot harder, I think, to chart your own course. And I really craved that creative control. So that for me was the pivot to business and to, you know, thinking about being part of that corporate world. You know, for others, it steered them in the opposite direction, right? They thought, no, I'm going to live my life. I'm going to be a performer, and this is what I'm destined to do. And so they doubled down on that. So I think everyone kind of absorbs that kind of shock in a different way.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny because you're kind of an opposite of a lot of the people I've interviewed where they all abandon the corporate world to go do something creative. And you basically abandon something creative to go do something corporate. So I wonder, when you are in the early stage of something, you mentioned growing something from 7 to 1,000 people. What goes into scaling something to that level?
Yeah. I mean, it didn't happen overnight. So, you know, it was over the course of many years. But for us, it was really about the culture. And that's the kind of work that I do now, is focusing on creative cultures, cultures that want to innovate and to build and to grow. And that requires a certain mindset among its founders, among its leadership team, to set the stage where people can bring their fresh ideas, where they're not scared to take risks. And cultivating that kind of environment is really appealing to me. So that's, I think, the secret sauce that we had as we scaled the organization. You know, we certainly made a lot of mistakes along the way. It wasn't a perfect path, but I think being safe to make those stumbles and to take risks was how the company was able to succeed, is by creating that kind of environment.
So there are two sides of this coin that I think about. And the reason I wanted to ask about this is because I'm in that process of thinking, okay, how do we grow beyond where we're at? You know, we raised an angel round that, you know, a couple of years ago. And now it's just like, okay, where is that lever that's going to get us to, you know, from three people working together to potentially being acquired by a big company?
Yeah.
And the thing that I wonder about is that, while you want to give people the freedom to take creative risks and bring lots of ideas to work, how do you filter that so that you actually stay focused? Because this is fresh in my mind because I've been working on our sort of product roadmap. And I remember looking at it with my community manager. I was like, this is way too complicated. There's too many things going on. I'm like, we're going to kill all this stuff. It's killing our focus. And at the same time, to your point, we need that freedom to basically play.
Yeah. It's such an interesting tension. And I think, you know, for us, and what I try to help other companies to do, is to really have that North Star. And I think you're onto something where it needs to be simple enough where everyone is clear about the vision, the mission, the organizational purpose. That's got to be really crystal clear. The values that we express along the way, how we're going to show up for each other. So I think that's a really good place to start before starting to scale and bringing more people on, because you know, you bring more people on, it becomes more complex. There are lots of different points of view, and that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But you need to have that North Star established first in order to get everyone aligned.
Well, let's go deeper into each one of these things, you know, vision, purpose, mission, because I think that often these words get thrown around a lot and they tend to basically just be buzzwords. But if you actually talk to people about these things, they don't actually have a clue. Because I remember the first time I ever interviewed Simon Sinek, he was like, your why is that you're obsessed with people who are good at unusual things. And I was like, that's great, Simon. What the hell am I supposed to do with that? And the funny thing is now, 10 years later, it's like, oh my God, every person that has been a guest on this podcast is a reflection of that core idea. And I realized everything we do here is driven by this fundamental belief that everybody has a story worth telling. And I was like, that's it. Everything we do needs to be an expression of that core idea. It's taken me a long time to come to that realization. But you know, when you walk people through figuring this stuff out, you know, like vision, purpose, mission, all of that, what is involved in this? Because I think that often these are concepts that can be very nebulous.
For sure. Yeah. And people have different interpretations of what that whole ecosystem is. I mean, for me, that why is the organizational purpose, right? That's the impact that you have on the world. That's kind of the big, big North Star. And I think that's always a good place to start. The vision and mission is the what and the how. So, you know, the vision being this is what we want to become, and the how, this is how we're going to get there. That's the mission. And then you kind of think about values. Well, how, you know, how is it going to show up in our behaviors? You know, what are we going to reward? What are we going to encourage people to do versus we're not going to tolerate that kind of behavior? That's really the values, what you care about. So, you know, I think understanding that ecosystem, getting clear about the definition always helps to kind of, okay, we're aligned on what we're trying to develop here. And then again, to your point, Srini, it's about story and really understanding, okay, these are the stories of our organization. This is what we really value. This is what we want to celebrate. And this is where it's actually come up. This is how it's lived. And getting those stories out of people is a great place to play and to help refine whatever your whole ecosystem of purpose, vision, mission, and values are.
Well, so one thing that I have noticed with a lot of people that are in our community or even my readers, my listeners, is that they feel that this creative part of them is something that has to be separate from the person that shows up at work. And it's like, oh, this creative thing I do on the side is like, no, that's completely irrelevant to my work. And I've so often found that the things that I have done that have no purpose or end in mind that are just creative things for fun have had a massive impact. So the entire visual aesthetic of Unmistakable Creative came from a 30-day project where I tried to teach myself how to draw and realized I couldn't draw. And but because of that, I started to actually figure out that I could collaborate with other people who could draw. I was like, oh, other people can bring my vision to life, even if I can't do this thing that I want to do. But I think that that's, I mean, I'm in, you know, the position to be able to do that because I own my own company and I, you know, basically the person who gets to make decisions, but I don't think a lot of people feel that freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. And this comes down to the culture piece, you know, our leaders creating those spaces for people to play and to do creative thinking and to do deep work. Are you just kind of a taskmaster and everything's just kind of drilling people down, wearing them down versus, okay, protect this, even if it's 15 minutes, honestly, do some creative thinking, you know, get your ideas out there and have that white space in which to play. I think that happens with great leadership and creative leadership. And to your point, you know, I think not only do people think, oh, this creative thinking is outside of my work life, a lot of people don't identify with being creative at all. And I think that's a real miss as well. You know, folks who are in finance or legal have the misperception that, oh, our organization or our function is not creative. We're not meant to be creative. When in reality, there's always room for incremental improvement and innovation and new ways of doing things. And that's got to be a muscle that's flexed and practiced and developed. So I think that's pretty important.
What do you see as the difference between organizations that foster this kind of thinking versus the ones that don't? Because I can tell you every company I worked at, I felt like this is a place where I am going to be rewarded for conformity and punished for going out of line.
Oh, it's so sad to me. That's so sad. I mean, there are big differences. And I think you see that in the relationship with customers. You see it in the stories across the organization, across the employee population. I mean, gosh, we're living in a time where if you don't get this right, people have so many choices, they're out the door. And I think 1 in 3 employees right now are actually engaged at work. So if you're dealing with that kind of backdrop, getting this right and focusing on culture is more important than it ever has been. And there's so much opportunity to make work a place where people can express themselves, where they are bringing their best ideas, but it needs to be intentional. It's not something that you can kind of take for granted and just say, oh yeah, they'll figure it out. To your point, it is a lot about top-down conformity and command and control, even though we know that there are better options out there.
Yeah. Well, so if you want to design an organization that fosters creativity, innovation, creative thinking, and you don't have the pockets of Google where you've got billions of dollars to basically explore batshit crazy ideas like let's go to space, which, by the way, like I had a friend who's working on a space travel company. He's like, do you know anybody who wants to go to space? I was like, I don't know anybody who wants to go to space because most of the people I know haven't seen enough of the Earth yet. And the more I thought about it, I was like, that just sounds like a really long airplane ride where you actually don't go anywhere. So no offense to people who are interested in space travel, but it just got me thinking about that. I was like, that's ridiculous. But to the point, you know, if you don't have, you know, Google's resources, how do you foster and design an environment like that intentionally to bring out this kind of thinking in people?
Yeah, well, I think there are a lot of different ways to think about it. And, you know, a big thing for me is storytelling. you know, getting people comfortable sharing stories of trying new things, exercising their growth mindset, and especially for leaders, demonstrating things that they did not do well. And that takes a lot of vulnerability and humility and, you know, basically the mindset that I don't have to be perfect as a leader. But that's really what employees are craving, is this permission to be human and to try things and to ask for help and support among their colleagues. And I think that's a really great place to start. And it's free, right? You can have a team meeting where, gosh, the last 15 minutes of the meeting, we're going to talk about things that we tried that did not go well. And we're going to support each other to extract the learning from that and to do things differently going forward. So that's just one practical thing to put into practice.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned industries like legal and finance. I did a bunch of interviews with our readers just to kind of understand what their challenges were so we could shape content accordingly. Mm-hmm. And one of them worked at a law firm. And she left me the question of how can you be creative when you work in an industry that's not? And I thought that is actually a really good question, because a lot of people, I think, when they work in industries that are not sexy or glamorous, are like, yeah, I work at a law firm. How can I possibly be creative there? Given your background and your research, how does that play out in environments that are not quote unquote creative?
Yeah. Well, I think, again, it's kind of the nomenclature of a law firm isn't creative. I would say a law firm has to be creative. If you have clients who are faced with challenges that have never been faced before and who are trying to negotiate and have mergers, I mean, negotiation is a creative endeavor, right? Finding a path and finding a solution is inherently creative. And I think it's about reframing and reshaping and giving your lawyers the permission to think creatively about how are we going to build our book of business, right? How are we going to acquire new clients or differentiate ourselves from the other white shoe law firm down the street? You know, there are lots of ways to bring creative thinking into those kinds of environments. But I think it takes kind of a reframe, reshaping of what the expectations are and really giving yourself permission to do things in a different way. And that's what companies and clients really are after.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about taking a risk, because I have seen this pattern over and over again in my life, that as people get older, as they become more and more conditioned by the world around them, their tolerance for risk goes down significantly. And it's funny, because if you look at the way that we educate, you look at a kindergarten classroom, it's basically a breeding ground for risk. And you look at a college classroom or even an MBA class, it's a breeding ground for conformity.
Yes.
And so basically, you've been taught, you know, your entire life to fit in, when we live in a world that rewards people for standing out. So how do you rebuild that tolerance for risk, both at an individual level and an organizational level?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're really onto something, especially among leaders. And I coach a lot of executives who are faced with that, right? They have a lot to lose. And I think, you know, we've kind of seen in this moment in time where, gosh, global pandemic, we have all these creative constraints put on us. Let's just cling to the status quo, right? Let's cling to what's certain, where in reality, it's the big bets of no, let's try something really different and see what our customers think of that. Those are the things that are breakthrough successes. And so I think for the leaders to understand and kind of get aligned on the value of trying things in a new way. And it doesn't have to be big, right? It doesn't have to be huge transformational change, but really getting comfortable with incremental improvement and experimentation as part of the mode of operation. And I think that's the muscle that we're trying to develop here.
Between reading the books of all the people I interview, writing articles, and managing my business, I have to deal with and process a lot of information. And one of the biggest causes of information overload and digital distractions in our modern lives is the way that we organize information. Using 20 different apps and sifting through folders is a bit like going to a different grocery store to buy every item on your list, but it doesn't have to be this way. If you've ever felt like you're completely buried by information overload, or you can't remember everything that's important, then maximize your output with Mem, our new knowledge management course, is just for you. Mem is the knowledge management app that helps you get a handle on everything from reducing information overload to remembering what matters and managing your tasks and projects more efficiently. In this course, you'll learn how to reduce information overload and focus on what's important, remember everything that matters with ease, and manage everything in one place and get more done in less time. I loved Mem so much that I ended up creating this course. And it's a perfect course for knowledge workers and creatives who want to take back control of their time and productivity. You can learn more about it at MaximizeYourOutput.com. Again, that's MaximizeYourOutput.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yeah, it's funny because I think that people don't see the degrees of risk when I talk to them about this. Like, I either have to do this, you know, huge thing or nothing at all. And I realize that everything that I've done has been a series of incremental risks where you get feedback. One thing I wonder is, when your risk doesn't pay off and it blows up in your face, how do you maintain the guts to do it again?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, a mentor of mine said, if you're not embarrassed by what you did 6 months ago, then you're not growing fast enough. You know, you kind of owe it to yourself to keep moving forward. And you know, one thing that I want to add is there's a risk to doing nothing. And I think that opportunity cost is often undervalued, you know, underassessed or underreported, where people think, oh, let's just keep doing what we're doing. There's really a risk in that as well. And so being clear about what are all the choices, and yes, there could be something that could blow up in your face, but you could also go under just by doing what you're doing today.
Yeah. Yeah, I try to think about risk from a sort of strategic standpoint of, okay, look at the downside, look at the upside, be calculated about it, but not reckless. So when you work with people, how do you define the distinction between strategic and reckless risks?
Well, you know, a lot of companies are embracing more data-informed business practices, which I think is great. And I think getting the data, really listening to customers first, that's a must, right? You can't just, to your point, be reckless. Hey, let's just try this, you know, throw it against the wall and see if it sticks. No, it really should be informed by the data that you're hearing from customers, the research that you've done across other similar industries or different industries that might apply. I mean, all of that planning has to be done. in order to make that safe bet. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, for me, that raises a question about looking at data and making data-driven decisions without compromising the integrity of the creativity. And I'll give you a more specific example to frame it. So one thing that I am known for is turning down very famous people who pitch us to be on the podcast, people that everybody listening to this has heard of. Like, I think I've probably even mentioned that we've turned down Gary Vaynerchuk multiple times. and that's something I'm proud of. And at the same time, I also know that Gary Vaynerchuk on the podcast would increase our metrics. And I've always had this line of, I will never compromise the integrity of the content to in service of the metrics. And sometimes I've had to do that. I will make guest choices and I'll choose a good story at the cost of our metrics, because I felt that in the long run, that would matter.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all about values, right? Going back to that. And I think,
and at the same time, we're running a business.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you think about it, you know, data is only as good as what you have been doing. And I think if you're really trying to do something differently, sometimes you have to look outside of the data set and think, well, what could it look like if we introduce something completely different? And I think that's what's powerful about creativity, is introducing something that's never been done before, something that is an outlier that's not in the data set. And we need to push ourselves to keep doing that. That's why, you know, diversity is so important, is you need those outliers to put you on a different path.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think back to this story, and I probably shared this before, where I was watching this documentary about Nike and sweatshops during the Olympics. And there was a journalist who was doing an expose for CBS, and Nike was sponsoring the Olympics that year. And she went through this whole expose, and then CBS killed the story because Nike was sponsoring the Olympics that year.
Oh, wow.
And part of me wonders, if I was the CEO of CBS, if I would have made the same decision.
Yeah.
You know, because at the end of the day, it's like, okay, this is millions of dollars we're talking about from an advertiser. Somebody brings in a ton of revenue. And, you know, there's a question of, okay, am I doing something unethical? Am I compromising my integrity, or am I actually doing what's right for the business?
Right. These are not easy decisions to make, you know, but that's a tough one.
Yeah. So where do people get this wrong? When you work with leaders, like, where have you seen them do things wrong that actually kill creativity in organizations?
Oh, gosh. I mean, your point about conformity really rings true. You know, I think one of the dangerous things is leading by fear and kind of setting that tone where people are really afraid to step out of what they've been doing. They're overly cautious about introducing their ideas. I mean, that's a big creativity killer. So I think that's a big one. It's just that psychological safety that's been either cultivated in the team or not. Mm-hmm. So that's a big watch out. And then I think, you know, what I see often is just over-engineering, where, you know, people are not robots or machines, and I'm all for process, but you need to give people a container in which to play and allow them to do things their own way and make it much more, you know, more why, less how. People will figure out their own how they're going to get it done. If you're really clear about the why, that's what's most important. And I think leaning into that is a better way to bring out creativity across the team.
Yeah. Well, one other thing I wonder is how organizations end up becoming less creative as they get bigger. Because I was going back through Salim Ismail's book, Exponential Organizations, and he talks about Kelly Johnson's Skunk Works, which was like this thing that started at Lockheed God knows how many years ago. And I remember pulling the essay on 12 rules, and they intentionally kept Skunk Works separate from the rest of the company, because like, if the rest of the company is involved in this, nothing will come out of here that's interesting or innovative, because they'll kill it with bureaucracy. And So as an organization scales and gets bigger, to your point, I have a lot more to lose now than I did when I first started the show and started the business. And so my risks have a very different consequence if they don't work. And at the same time, the very things that got me into this position are the risks that I took. So it's this chicken and egg problem.
Yeah. I love that book, by the way. You know, I think Jennifer Mueller talks about creative blockers, and it's a really interesting concept where you have to make sure that creative ideas have a chance to flow up through the organization, and that you're really aware of the folks who are either green lighting them or blocking them. And a lot of times, with the best intentions, people will say no to ideas that are creative because they look foreign and different and it's uncomfortable, right? It's something you've never seen before. And so to your point about risk, they're not willing to take that risk and try it out. And it just dies before it even has a chance to be, experimented with. So I think being really mindful of, okay, where are our gatekeepers for creative ideas across the organization? And how are we allowing folks at all levels to introduce new ideas in a way that sometimes is anonymous? So you're not attaching, okay, an intern suggested this, we're going to say no. No, it's anonymous. We're going to look at the idea in isolation. I think that's also a really important technique for businesses, is to have that objectivity a little bit.
Hmm. Well, I want to kind of bring us full circle. We started out talking about where we went to college, Northwestern, Berkeley, and then, you know, obviously you went to NYU Stern, and I went to business school. And we're talking about the fact that so many people are trained to be taskmasters, and I don't honestly think that business school prepares anybody to run a business. I think that I even had an article titled "Business School Teaches You Nothing About Running a Business," because I realized it doesn't. It teaches you how to be an employee in somebody else's. So when you think about sort of how we are going to educate people for the future, particularly given your background and the work that you do and having gone to two elite universities, what would you change about the way that we educate people?
Oh, gosh. And this rings true as a parent as well. You know, I think about
that's why I asked the question.
Yeah. And when my daughter started kindergarten, I remember her reflecting and saying, gosh, Mom, you know, it's just so structured, you know, and for her as a kindergartner at 5 years old to recognize, well, gosh, you know, you have to sit at this time and you have to do this at this time. Obviously, there are alternate schools out there that teach in a very different way. But I think to your point about entrepreneurs and how do you cultivate those skills? I'm a big fan of kind of incubation labs and learning labs. I'm an advisor to a venture firm called Dangerous Ventures, and they're really trying to tap into what are the skills that help entrepreneurs to thrive and to be successful, really thinking about the competencies required and how do we cultivate those and get folks to practice those. It has nothing to do with school. I couldn't agree more, Srini, that, you know, going to Stern, it was not how I got my business chops. It was really by trial and error and seeing, well, gosh, this works, or, you know, or I'm well-networked and I know these people and that really helps me to connect the dots. And I think it's a lot more about lived experience.
Well, you know, I think Naval Ravikant had a really good way of expressing this. He, you know, did this podcast titled How to Get Rich Without Getting Lucky. And funny enough, I don't listen to podcasts at all, but I have listened to that dozens of times. And one of the things that he said was that there are idiosyncrasies that express themselves in, you know, practice that don't in theory. And yeah. I thought about that from the standpoint of sort of like a business school case study. I was like, yeah, in a business school case study, the people are static. They don't, you know, waver between being gigantic assholes and the nicest people in the world or being, you know, brilliant and complete morons.
Right. Yeah, that's so true. You know, I love kind of role plays as well as a way to learn and to really, it's probably back to my acting roots, but just kind of embodying, okay, these are the set of circumstances. How would you really behave under these conditions? And let's play it out and let's try it on. And you can really learn a lot from those exchanges. Yeah.
So two sort of final questions. Like when people come to you to hire you and ask you to come into an organization, what are the problems that they're asking yourself? Like why does somebody typically come to you and what are they looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of organizations are trying to figure out how do we create the culture that we want under these sets of circumstances that we never predicted. You know, folks who are moving to more of a hybrid setting or going completely remote? And how do we preserve and really strengthen our culture under these conditions? So a lot of the time we're thinking through what's the strategy to ensure that our culture can thrive, that people can build the skills and relationships to feel connected to the organization, and that they're given the tools to really innovate and bring their creative thinking to the workplace. So that could be a small company that's really just, you know, hyper growth, trying to figure it out. They're hiring a lot of people. And it can be also a large organization that's trying to ensure that their culture is ethical and strong under these conditions.
So I know I said I had two more questions. I guess it was three, because this is actually one thing I've wondered a lot about ever since I left the corporate world. I was a terrible employee and I was constantly being put on performance improvement plans. It's not no surprise that I didn't work out. But one thing that I kept coming back to was this idea of mismatching talent with environment that I just kept seeing over and over again. And I thought to myself, if somebody had put me in a different job, I probably would have thrived. And I always jokingly say, I was like, performance improvement plans don't improve performance. They prevent wrongful termination lawsuits. and it's true. I don't know anybody. I don't ever remember getting off of one of those plans and thinking, oh, now my job is safe. Most of the time it was like, I'm on this performance improvement plan. I got 3 weeks to find a new job. And I look back at it and said, you know, rather than saying, okay, like this person is underperforming, there's never a question as like to whether this person is in the right role to begin with. Have we aligned their strengths with the job that they're doing?
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a powerful insight. And I think, there are some organizations that really lean into that and who are open to shuffling people around and are really thinking about skills and strengths, to your point. And some that are just not set up for that, which is a shame because, you know, the talent that you have within your organization, they're right there, you know, and if you can tap into that potential and to develop it in the right way.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I believe you can, you know, really help the organization to go in the right direction. But you're right. Sometimes they're just sitting in the wrong seat.
Yeah. I was telling a friend the other day, I said, if I went back to corporate now, one of two things would happen. I'd get promoted in the first week or I'd get fired on the first day.
That's right.
because I have like so many data points from having had thousands of conversations on this podcast with people that I'd probably see things that most people can't. Yeah. And I would either go too fast for most people and then look like I'm doing nothing, or I'd get fired on day one.
Well, you're going in with the right kind of expectations, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been really fascinating. I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, I think that someone who can tap into creativity and be completely themselves unapologetically makes them pretty unmistakable. And that means being perfectly imperfect. And I think our world needs a lot more of that.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your wisdom and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
Yeah, you can check me out. I'm on Instagram at annjacoby.author. And then my website is springstreetco.com.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World. And this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.